Interview with William Brodsky, January 5th, 2010, in Chicago, Illinois, by Kenneth Durr. All right, great. I saw somewhere a mention that you'd been at the stock exchange when you were 16 years old, on the floor or something like that.
My first job on Wall Street was on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange in 1961, when I was 17 years old. And it was a eye-opening experience, something I wanted to do. And I worked for a firm that was long gone now called DeCoppett and DeRemus. There were two firms on the New York Stock Exchange floor in those days that had a special license to handle odd lots, an odd lot being under 100 shares. So if Merrill Lynch wanted to buy 150 shares of stock, the Merrill Lynch broker would buy 100 shares of stock, well, could buy 100 shares of stock, but the 50 shares had to be done through one of the two odd lot firms. One was called DeCoppett and DeRemus, the other was called Carlyle and Jacklin. And basically, if it were 150 shares, they'd give the order to one of the two firms, and they would buy the 100 shares at whatever the market price was. Right. And then they would have a markup on the odd lot, an eighth of a point extra up to $25 a share, and a quarter of a point over. So one of the interesting things as you look back is how expensive things were to do back then, because it was all manual.
Right. Now, was this sort of an internship or something like that?
It was a summer job that I was able to obtain because my father was on Wall Street in the business, and he knew I wanted to work on Wall Street, and this was my first taste of the business.
Okay.
And the way he did it is he never wanted me to work for his firm. So he traded me with a fellow from another firm, and he took his son.
Okay.
So I was a trade, and we made $1 an hour.
Oh, boy.
And the problem is that the stock exchange in those days was open from 10 until 3, so I made $6 a day. But I was a teenager, and I ate more in food than I made.
Well, then you went to Syracuse, I guess.
Yes.
Now, it sounds like you were pretty much determined to work in the finance industry.
Yes.
But you got a law degree. What was your thinking behind that?
I guess at that time, my orientation was more to have a law degree for the value of what a law degree provided, but not necessarily to practice law in a traditional way. And in fact, when I graduated from law school, I went to a brokerage firm and was a lawyer at the brokerage firm.
Hmm.
And I was in the what was then called the compliance department, which was a whole new concept back then.
Okay.
Compliance, as we know it today, is a big part of the industry, but it was not in those days. So I had the benefit of being in a small firm and learning a lot about the business from many facets, because the smaller the firm, the more you could interact with more different problems, mm-hmm. issues.
So how did you get to the Amex? Tell me a little bit.
What happened is in 1972 and 3, Wall Street was getting ready for a major change, and that was what was called May Day. May Day was the change from fixed to unfixed commissions. And the first date was May 1st, 1973, when commissions on the trading floor would be unfixed, as I recall. And then May 1st, 1974, when commissions for the public would be unfixed. So commissions for the first time in the history of the stock exchange in New York would be negotiable. And the firm I was with, which was a very what you might call an institutional boutique, Modell Roland and Company, recognized that the new world would be a very difficult place for them to adjust to, because they didn't have the capital that some of their big competitors had, and their big competitors were Goldman Sachs, Salomon Brothers, and Drexel Burnham. Those were the firms that they were their competitors. And so the partners, many of whom were approaching retirement age, wanted to find a way to get their capital out, and they merged. They were planning to basically sell out. And so I looked at it and I said, you know, this is a time of great turmoil in the business. Why don't I go do something else, kind of wait this period out? And I started looking for jobs, particularly at either the New York Stock Exchange or the American Stock Exchange. And I was very fortunate to get a very
attractive job offer at the American Stock Exchange, which at the time was very highly thought of as a place for professionals to work. Their staff had a very, very good reputation. A lot of the reason was that some of the best and the brightest people who had worked at the SEC in the 60s had gone to the American Stock Exchange, people such as Ralph Saul, Bob Birnbaum, and Norman Poser, all of whom worked on the special study of the securities markets. And the chairman at the time and CEO was a wonderful guy named Paul Colton, who was someone who had come to the American Stock Exchange from the New York Stock Exchange. So all those things interested me, and it was a perfect, the job was a perfect match for my background because it was in the government relations and policy planning area. So although I went as a lawyer, I was really going in a, I wasn't doing what I would call grunt legal work, I was doing policy issues. And one of my first assignments was to work with people in Washington on what later became known as the Securities Acts, ACTS, amendments of 1975, which really laid the groundwork for the national market system, some of which is only now being fully realized in terms of, you know, open access, real competition. The whole goal was to break the monopoly of the New York Stock Exchange, which took more than 30 years.
Yeah.
It actually took more than 30 years. So I went there in the winter of 1974, the American Stock Exchange, in the policy planning area. But a funny thing happened, and that is that I had done work at Modell Roland to get the firm qualified to become a member of this newfangled exchange in Chicago called the Chicago Board Options Exchange. Mm. And I had written an article about the CBOE that had been published in a prestigious securities law journal. And not 2 months after I joined the American Stock Exchange, that they said, you know something about these new options. We want to get in the business. You can help us do that. So I, even though I stayed in this policy planning area for a while, I was really part of the new product development team that got Amex to be the second exchange in the world to get into options. And actually, options to a large extent saved the Amex decades later.
Right. Thumbnail. What was that task about? What were your priorities and what were the steps you ran through? In terms of getting Amex up into the world of options.
Well, there were two challenges. The two biggest challenges was that, one, the old-timers of the Amex thought of themselves as a stock exchange and looked down on options as being something unseemly. And so that was a big hurdle. And what I did is I ultimately became head of the option division at 32 years of age, and I assembled a team of people who worked for me, and we were like what I would call an exchange within the exchange, because the stock people wanted nothing to do with us. Including the traders, by the way, on the floor. The second thing is that one of the biggest impediments was the SEC. The SEC was a very difficult impediment in terms of getting the CBOE launched. I think it took 5 years. And then when the Amex came in, the SEC was equally challenging in terms of all the things, the hurdles that we had to traverse. Now, one of the most interesting things that the SEC did is that CBOE at the time was in the business, you know, a year and a half, and it wanted to expand the amount of options it offered, and they wanted to get into put trading. The Amex, on the other hand, wanted to get into the business. So the SEC said, look, CBOE, if you want to expand, and Amex, if you want to get into the business, what we want is basically one clearinghouse. And this was a very novel concept because at that point in time, each exchange in the country had its own clearinghouse. So the SEC did something that probably in a traditional legal sense was completely illegal, but they used their persuasive powers because they had the power to approve a new exchange or the rules to create an option division within an exchange. And they basically forced the SEC, forced the Amex and the CBOE to make a deal. And in exchange for the ability to expand, the CBOE let Amex become 50% owner of this new clearing entity, which had been the CBOE Clearing Corp, and it became the Options Clearing Corp, which probably today is the largest derivative clearinghouse in the world. It has an exemplary record, and it was really built not only on the foundation of what CBOE started, but it was because of the Amex trying to get into the business is how it became more mutualized and served all exchanges.
Okay. So was the Pacific Exchange coming in at that point too?
Well, in the sequence of things, the Pacific Exchange, the Philadelphia Exchange came next. They were third, and then the Pacific Exchange was fourth, and then later the Midwest Stock Exchange was fifth. Unfortunately for them, they came in late and then they got out early. Then later the New York Stock Exchange, who had looked completely down on options, came in even later and later sold out to the CBOE in 1997 because Grasso at those days didn't want anything to do with options.
Right.
And it turns out now that if you look at the business plan of the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ, options are a vital and very, very important part of the not only the growth of these multi-line exchanges, but very big part of their profitability.
Right. You were talking about the SEC and some of the challenges they put up. You would have been, you know, really trying to make get the Amex options business really moving when the SEC puts in the freeze on options. And one would think that that would be, you know, a hell of a thing to have happen to your business. Tell me a little bit about how you dealt with that period.
Yeah, that was 1978, and I think what drove it was that the SEC realized that the option business was growing faster than they could really cope with it. And so they decided to impose what was known as the options moratorium. And it gave the SEC a breather where they could sort of get their arms more around the business. And it was a big blow to those of us in the business because there was a demand. In fact, one of my fondest recollections of running the option business at the Amex in the 70s was that as a stock exchange, we felt that if we listed an option on a company, we would write them a letter and say, congratulations, we have great news, we're going to list options on your stock. And I would get, as head of the option division, I'd sign the letters, the most irate phone calls from the CEOs of these public companies, like, how dare you, and you don't have a right to do it, and, you know, we don't want options on our stock. And by the time I left the Amex 4 or 5 years later, companies were begging us to list options on their stocks because what was developing was a two-tier market. Companies that had options on their stocks, the companies realized had greater liquidity and more investor interest because options enhanced the ability of investors to use those stocks as investment vehicles. And so it was kind of an interesting thing to see this sea change from belligerence to how do we get our stock listed.
What was behind the belligerence?
Belligerence was lack of knowledge.
Was there a sense that, you know, you're sort of gambling on our company? And
I think that there was the gambling aspect, but I think it was also the term of the time was the tails wagging the dog, those kind of concepts, because there wasn't a lot of empirical data. People didn't have years of experience because, you know, in those days, the only options that traded on exchanges were on U.S. exchanges, and there just wasn't a lot of you know, analytical information on these things.
Okay. So this sea change, you saw that by the time you decided to leave the Amex, I guess. So things were chugging along pretty well there.
I was very happy at the Amex and looked at having a pretty good long career there. But a headhunter from Chicago came my way and said to me that there's an exchange in Chicago that was interested in hiring me to be chief operating officer, and that in addition, they had just secured a license from Standard & Poor's to trade options on the S&P 500, I'm sorry, futures on the S&P 500 index. And so here I was, 38 years old, and I looked at my future at the Amex, which although it was good, there were several people ahead of me, including Arthur Levitt, who was chairman and CEO at the time. And I said, these people are not going anywhere. This is an opportunity to kind of leapfrog my career. And the biggest challenge for me was to move my family to Chicago because we were dyed-in-the-wool New Yorkers, and the idea of picking up everything you ever knew and learned and moving to Chicago was a big deal. What made it easier was that for my 7 or 8 years at the Amex in the option industry, I was on the board of the Options Clearing Corp as the Amex's representative, and I would come to Chicago every other month for board meetings. And so I knew that Chicago was not only a nice city, but what was even more important is the culture of Chicago and its intense interest in building derivatives on options and futures on financial instruments was quite remarkable. So I had gotten to know the people in Chicago. So from a professional point of view, I knew that the action, the innovation, and the growth in futures and options was Chicago. And so when I finally accepted the position to come to the CME, which was in August of 1982, people in New York looked at me like I was crazy. What are you doing? You're leaving the center of finance, the capital of the financial world, to move to the Wild West. And I understood something they didn't, and that was that the real innovation was happening in Chicago. And I went to the CME because of stock index futures and the opportunity to grow professionally of really running the exchange, because chief operating officer at the time really ran the exchange.
Was the S&P 500 futures the first one, the first really big stock
index? It was the first big stock index future. Actually, the first one to start trading was in Kansas City in February of 82. But the CME was so intent on making it successful that it had a great critical mass of traders, and the S&P 500 was the bigger name, and it just bullied its way in terms of just sheer determination to build the liquidity and make it work.
Did you have a sense that it was going to do that when you first, you said it was just coming out when you made it?
Well, when they approached me, they had just started trading, and it was still very embryonic. But I also was impressed by the people at the exchange and by the sheer size of the exchange. And when I was at the Amex, there were about 650 members of the Amex total. New York Stock Exchange had at the time 1,366 members total. When I joined the CME, they had just created a new index and option market division, which if you combined it with the already existing membership ranks that they had more than 2,000 members. So just as the sheer depth of trading talent was staggering. And it was a much more open community than the New York financial community. We used to kid around that if you wanted to become a specialist at the New York Stock Exchange, you had to have a father who was a specialist. Where in Chicago, people were given much more opportunity to break into the system without any pedigrees, without any connections. And in that sense, it was very... what I call uplifting and a breath of fresh air to see that there was an openness to allowing people who didn't have connections come in. And I think that that was also a hallmark of the Chicago community, much more than the New York community. Yeah. New York community was much more closed.
Meritocracy.
Yes.
Well, Leo Melamed would be a good example of that, I guess.
Okay. Well, he and Jack Sander actually hired me.
Okay.
And I was very impressed with them. And truthfully, I'm still friends with them today. They hired me to come in, and it was under them that I became president of the exchange in 1985. So I became president and CEO June 1st of 1985, and come this June, I will have been CEO of two of Chicago's largest exchanges for 25 years.
Hmm. So did you take your chief challenge at this point to really leverage these stock index futures and things like that?
Well, the biggest challenge was literally was education of the financial community. Most people looked at what we had created at the Merck in stock index futures as a bunch of wild-eyed pork belly traders trying to interfere with the smooth functioning of the financial markets. And there was either distrust or disgust that how are these people, who are these people in Chicago dare to trade financial instruments? And the New York Stock Exchange, on one hand, as they did with options, look down on the futures. But it didn't take long for the people there, the leadership there, to understand that this was something significant. Mm-hmm. And John Phelan, who was chairman of the New York Stock Exchange at the time, he was actually president at the time, recognized the importance of this and created the New York Futures Exchange. And they started trading futures on the New York Stock Exchange Composite Index as a competitive initiative. But the reality is that the CME not only had a head start and it had the better index, but it also had the determination and the troops, because the New York Stock Exchange was always wedded into what the way they always did things. So they believed they needed specialists, and it was just based on a much more rigid approach to a business structure. Mm-hmm. And there was a feeling for a while that, you know, the sheer fact that it was New York would overtake it. And in fact, they tried to trade Treasury bond futures. And they even hired the president of the CBOE to become the president of the New York Futures Exchange, Bill Smith. So this was a real New York-Chicago brawl of sorts. But it didn't in any way take away from the underlying economic value of using a stock index future as a both a hedging vehicle and as a cash substitute or substitute for buying the stocks themselves. And in fact, one of the things I found the most fascinating in the early days is I've been a stockholder of the S&P 500 index fund through Vanguard for many years, and I would read, as a securities lawyer, I would read the prospectus just to understand how they were explaining the product. And buried in the prospectus early on was the fact that Vanguard was using the S&P 500 future as a way of making sure that they had cash available to the mutual fund, so that since the fund had to always be invested in stocks, but they also had to make sure that there was cash available for redemptions, they would use a certain amount of the money in the fund in stock index futures and keep some cash in T-bills available for redemption and therefore always be fully invested. So it said to me that was a validation that this is not just for speculation. Right. There's highly legitimate ways of using this vehicle.
There were a lot of people saying that up until the market break in 87 when things changed a little bit.
In fact, there was one major event that preceded that, and that was the phenomenon that was known as triple witching. Right. And as soon as stock index futures started to really grow, it became obvious that there was an effect on expiration Fridays on the stock market when the futures and the options would expire at the same time, and it was called triple witching. It was the expiration of the individual equity options originally created at the CBOE but now traded all over, so options on IBM, GE, Microsoft, etc. The expiration of stock index options at the CBOE, which CBOE created, which was the S&P, now became the S&P 100 and later the S&P 500 option. And third was the expiration of the futures on the S&P 500. And when all those would expire quarterly on the same day, at the end of the day, it would create disruption in the stock market because it all happened at the close. And the specialist system, quite frankly, was not equipped to handle the enormous volumes, both buy and sell volumes, that occurred at the close. Mm-hmm. So at that time, the Merck leadership and the New York Stock Exchange leadership sat down together, and we made a deal that was something that I understood and convinced my Merck colleagues was a legitimate compromise, and that was to move the expiration of the stock index futures from the close of the day on Friday, which is the worst time because no one wants to get stuck with a position over a weekend,
right,
to the opening in the morning on Friday. Okay. And that preceded the crash of 87. And that was a very important thing because it was a private sector solution to both a real and a perceived problem. And triple witching at that time was a big deal. People, you know, it was like a day where people would quake.
Right.
What's going to happen at the close? Is the market going to go up 200, down 200? And so we actually solved that problem. And it's good that we did. Now, that was, I can't tell you precisely, but 86, 87, but before the crash of October 19th of 87.
Right.
And, of course, the crash of 1987 was based on a lot of macroeconomic forces, and a lot's been written on it, and
yep,
I could go into it in length, but I think in general, the market was overvalued, interest rates were too high, and I can tell you I knew on Sunday night, based on what was going on in Asia, and then even before the opening, what was going on in Europe, that we were going to have a terrible, terrible day. And I was in the office very early that morning. And it was a terrible, terrible day. And part of the problem was that there were people who were using portfolio insurance, and as with what we've been through recently in terms of a market disruption, people always assume that the liquidity that you have when things are calm are going to be there when things are not calm. And it was a disastrous day because everyone wanted to sell at the same time and there weren't enough buyers, literally. And, of course, then we had, after the crash and the aftermath, a big study by Nick Brady and a very fine staff run by Bob Glauber up at Harvard. And the bottom line of the report was that, lo and behold, Wall Street or the government, through this study, said that these markets, both the futures markets on stock indexes, the options markets, and the stock markets, were really one market. Now, to those of us in Chicago, that was not a surprise. We knew these markets were interconnected. They weren't separate markets. Right. And, of course, to the New Yorkers, who kind of rejected the fact that anything legitimate could ever go on outside of 10 blocks away from Wall Street, that, in fact, the Chicago markets were literally linked to the New York markets, even if the New Yorkers didn't want to acknowledge it.
Right. Well, you're trading on the S&P. You're watching the New
York. Well, not only that, the futures were a leading indicator of what the stock market was going to do, whether it was an hour in advance or a minute in advance.
Right.
Because there was no other place in the past. You know, the Dow or the S&P cash index reflects the prices of what had already occurred, where the futures were basically a little bit of a predictor of what's going to occur.
Right. But nonetheless, and just to sort of move out of your time at the Merck, nonetheless, you know, the volume of contracts or futures contracts went down tremendously after that. The people stopped being involved. You've got the SEC, David Reuter, saying, it's all the futures' fault. How did you sort of dig your way out of that?
Yeah, I testified in Congress a lot during that period, and David Reuter and I locked horns a lot. One of the frustrations I've always had is that the SEC has been run by too many lawyers. And so in this case, I'm proud that I'm a lawyer because I feel I can criticize lawyers more easily. But I think it's very important to recognize that markets are economic mechanisms. And unfortunately, when David Reuter said it's all the fault of the futures markets, in my view, he didn't have the facts. And we didn't have the Brady Report. We didn't see how these markets were linked. And there has been and continues to be a certain frustration that the SEC doesn't regulate the stock index futures markets. So, for example, margin levels were very different in the stock index futures markets than they were in the comparable options markets. And that concept continues today, though much less so, because our regulatory system grew up in two different ways. The futures markets are regulated through the agriculture committees, and the equity markets through the what's now financial services committees. So there's always been a tension. And to a certain extent, the SEC was never as vigorous as it should have been in terms of getting jurisdiction in the first place.
Right.
And the famous Shad-Johnson Accord of 1982 kind of solidified that there was going to be this bifurcated structure. So, I would say that there were some major issues, clearly when David Reuter was chairman and certainly when Richard Breeden was chairman of the SEC. But I will tell you, having been at the CME at the time, we fought like crazy to preserve the jurisdiction of the CFTC because we feared that the SEC would not look at these markets in an economic way, but rather in a kind of regulatory way without the real heavy economics that we had on the future side. And that issue still exists today. The SEC is still too dominated by lawyers. I have no hesitance to say it. And the CFTC is, on the other hand, very dominated by economists. There's probably something in the middle that would be probably a preferable balance, but you're not going to see that happen too easily.
No time soon.
Yeah.
You ended up going from the CFTC-regulated Merck into the CBOE with the good old SEC to deal with. How did that happen? Where did that transition come
from? Well, I had been at the CME almost 15 years, and I was getting offers to come back to New York as well as an offer to come to the CBOE, and I just felt that it was time to make a change. I felt that at that stage of my life that was a unique time, and I had spent, as I said, almost 15 years at the CME, and I felt it was time to make a change. And I was very glad that the CBOE offer came about. It was kind of a very special situation, since my most memorable experience of being in the securities business was being head of options at the Amex.
Mm-hmm.
So to come to the exchange that was my arch enemy and was and continues to be the leader of the option industry was a very special and unique opportunity for me.
What were the strengths that the CBOE had back in the late 1990s?
I think it certainly had the innovative record. The CBOE has always been and continues to be the innovator in the option business. At a time where other exchanges, the American Stock Exchange was a very substantial exchange when it competed with the CBOE and was always number two to the CBOE for many, many years. But the CBOE always innovated both in terms of products. It created the first index options. It pioneered the concept of flex options, which is where you can modify the terms of the option. It created the volatility index in the 90s. And then in the recent decade, we created volatility as a tradable product, both in futures and options. So clearly, CBOE always had the leadership, both in terms of products and in terms of industry leadership in Washington on regulatory issues. So I was very aware of that. And, of course, CBOE also had a unique situation, and that is when I came to the CBOE, 27 of the 30 Dow stocks were solely listed on the CBOE. And that became, very soon after I joined the CBOE, an issue between the CBOE and the SEC and the Justice Department of should there be multiple listing of options. And so when I saw the handwriting on the wall, the thing that I did was I led the initiative to multiply list options on other exchanges, figuring we ought to do it before the government forces us to do it. And that was a very challenging time, and I believe that was in 1999. Now, we also knew ISE was coming on board, and they were going to be the first totally electronic exchange, and I felt that we'd be better placed to compete with a really electronic exchange if we were multiply listing options with other exchanges, because we would have been better placed competitively.
Now, does this get to the consent decree that was signed?
Yeah, what happened is the Justice Department came to us and said, why aren't you multiply listing these options? And basically my answer to them was, look, if there are three gas stations on an intersection corner, why should the government come in and tell me that I have to open a gas station on the fourth corner? It didn't make sense, particularly since we had all the good products, because it wasn't all the same gasoline. We had IBM and GE and Coca-Cola and most of, as I said, 27 of the Dow stocks.
Were the other options exchanges tending to sell other things because in order to make their niche?
No, there was a lot of history here. There were incidents back in the 70s where CBOE and Amex both listed the same option, and there were difficult problems with pricing, where customers' orders at Merrill Lynch would be sent to one exchange and from Dean Witter sent to another exchange, and the prices were completely out of whack. So it wasn't fair to the customers. So the SEC was struggling with how to make it more fair to customers, and there wasn't a linkage in the option markets at the time. So at a certain point in time, the SEC said, we're not going to have multiple listing anymore. We're going to have a lottery. So the SEC mandated this lottery. Mm-hmm. So we were operating under this lottery, and then the Justice Department said, you know, the fact that you don't have a lottery, we don't care. Basically, the Justice Department ignored the SEC. The SEC was not a player here and basically threatened us. And so I was the one that initiated the multiple listing just to say to the Justice Department, look, we'll do it. Don't tell us what to do. We'll do it. But nevertheless, they wanted their, as Joel Klein said to me at the time, because I went in to see him, he was head of antitrust, he says, we want a piece of flesh. Even if you said you're going to multiply list, we don't care. You're going to have to consent. So it was, I think, very unfair of how it was handled, because the SEC, in my view, completely abrogated their responsibility here and basically let the Justice Department run away with it. And they never said, hey, you know what? We told these exchanges that we're going to have a lottery. We told them implicitly that we have giving them protection from the antitrust laws. Therefore, the Justice Department never should have threatened us the way they did. But life is the way it is. I made the deal. We had a consent decree. There were no fines, but we had to make a consent. So we did.
So did you just travel around and talk to the heads of the other exchanges and say, this is what we need to
do? No, I couldn't
do
it. Couldn't do it.
How did you?
We weren't allowed to do it. We made a decision one day that we were going to list options on Dell Computer on the Philadelphia Exchange and Microsoft on the Pacific, and it created a war. And we knew that we had more to lose than to gain, which is why we hadn't done it in the first place.
Okay.
Because if you have 27 of 30 Dow stocks and there are five other good options out there, we go after five, they go after our 27.
Right.
But we made a business decision to do it as a way of kind of taking the initiative away from the Justice Department, because if we hadn't done it, it could have been a lot worse.
Okay. So that was a pretty big step then, sort of changing the whole terms of the...
Right. And again, part of it was tied to the fact that we knew ISE was coming on, that we were going to have to compete anyway, and why not just get it over with?
Right. A little more about ISE. This is going to... All the other options exchanges have got the open outcry. They've got the floor.
Mm-hmm.
ISE is going to be totally electronic, right? What did you expect to happen when that came online?
We really didn't know, but what we decided that was that we can't allow, as the leading exchange, someone to come up with a new mousetrap and not have a mousetrap of our own. Mm-hmm. So I went to the membership, I think it was in 2000, and literally got permission by getting a vote to spend $50 million, this is more than 10 years ago, to build our own electronic trading system. Mm-hmm. But I had to do it with a condition that I couldn't turn it on unless I went back to the membership for a vote, because the floor in those days was so powerful. And in fact, that's what we did. But when ISE came on, it started slowly, so people said, it doesn't mean anything. But with every passing month, they started gaining market share and gaining and gaining. And so we then modified our plan to have an electronic trading system that we called the hybrid, which was the combination of the floor and the off-floor, which then made us necessary to rewrite the system for the electronic system. And we lost 2.5 to 3 years doing all that. In the meantime, ISE was taking market share from us day by day, week by week, month by month. And so by the time we were starting to turn on the system, we were now playing catch-up. Okay. Because they had actually gained so much market share. And in fact, this, as we're speaking now at the beginning of 2010, we are stronger now than we've been vis-a-vis ISE in more than 5 years. That we have clawed our way back, because once customers got used to trading electronically, in the same way that people now make their plane reservations electronically, they don't go back to the old system.
Right.
So we had lost a lot of business. On the other hand, we were the first exchange to create a true hybrid trading system, which actually works. And so although 95% of our trades are done electronically, we still do about 25% of our volume in open outcry, which is a real testament to what we created when we built our system called the hybrid.
Would that have happened had the floor traders not have been so powerful? I mean, it sounds like
No. There was a big fight. I actually have buttons that say Brodsky must go. Hmm. They were out to get me because they knew that if we succeeded in putting electronics in, that many of them would be out of business.
Right.
And my view was, and a lot of it went back to my days at the Amex of being in great respect of what CBOE meant as an institution, that I was not going to allow during my tenure CBOE as an institution to slide into an abyss because of some narrow-minded floor traders who are only worried about their own short-term income.
So at this point, what's the attraction? What's the attraction for the open outcry system? Why are those 25% of your business still
the answer is because customers want the business done that way, that there are still trades that get done through human interaction and through negotiation, whether they're complex trades with the very large trades, or they're trades when markets are very volatile where they want human judgment. And we don't mandate how a customer's orders are executed. It is totally up to the customers. But if you went down to our floor today, you would see major firms such as Goldman Sachs and other firms that use independent brokers who rely on individual human beings to facilitate their orders only because they're willing to pay extra to have them done that way. And that was what the New York Stock Exchange hoped to do, but they were behind the eight ball because they hadn't prepared for the electronics. So when John Thain took over, one of the first things he did is he had to buy Archipelago because it gave him the electronic platform, but he didn't have much time to integrate and create a real hybrid, which they suffer from today.
Right. Other things that you were faced with at this point. You did a big a long-term strategic plan in late 90s, early 2000s when you came in. Was demutualization a component of that from the very beginning?
No, demutualization came somewhat later because I would say that, first of all, there were no exchanges in the United States demutualized before 2000. It started, the first exchange in the world was Australia, and the very strong culture in Chicago of the power of floor members made demutualization kind of an anathema to them. Their view was, I don't want the institution to make money, I'll make the money. So we ran them really as nonprofit cooperatives. And by the way, the New York Stock Exchange was no different.
Right.
And in fact, over the years, much of the people who owned the seats had retired and were now leasing out their seats, and the seats became very profitable to the owners in terms of monthly rents. Both CBOE and New York Stock Exchange, the rents were shockingly high, and the returns were better than you could get any place else. So people who own the seats say, why would I want this any differently? What really happened is the Merck found themselves in a very politically difficult situation where the whole governance was crumbling, and had a little bit to do with why I left the Merck and came here. And it took several years after I left for that reality to come home to roost. So the Merck didn't wake up one day and say, oh, we think we'll demutualize because our stock will be worth a lot. The managing the membership and the conflicts of interest within the membership really forced the Merck to demutualize. And the demutualization inevitably led to the IPO. But then the IPO was staggeringly successful because at the time of the IPO, people had no idea what exchanges were worth. So the Merck stock went from 35 literally up to the hundreds straight up because people who on the investment side at the big brokerage firms and institutional investors started understanding the operating leverage of exchanges. And so instead of giving the money back to the seat owners, if you could handle it within this corporate entity and make this a valuable business, all of a sudden the stock was worth a lot. So from the time the Merck went public and the stock shot up, then it became almost inevitable that other exchanges would want to demutualize.
Okay.
And of course, CBOE had its own unique problem of this exercise right issue with the Board of Trade, which has, until this year, made it impossible for us to demutualize. And, you know, we are now here talking about our demutualization because we finally, after over 4 years, have freed ourselves of the litigation that's going to allow us to do the same.
The idea, though, is that when all these exchanges are sort of realizing this intrinsic value that had never been realized before, if you didn't do it, if CBOE didn't do it, somebody was going to, you basically were going to lose out. Was that
well,
the idea?
Well, you lose out what I would call strategic optionality. People will come to us and say, hey, let's merge. Hey, let's do a deal together. Why don't we take over you, you take over us, or any of many strategic things that companies can do, we couldn't do it. Because if you have seat holders, to try to get them to vote to do something of a strategic nature is almost impossible. So you had to create a corporate form where you could do things more like a public company as opposed to what was really a country club structure.
When did you... I mean, I've looked at this on the New York Stock Exchange, and of course Dick Grasso's story is really tied up in working with these people on the floor and this big political power. How did you deal with that, and when did you hit the point where you could realize the things you wanted to realize for CBOE above these sort of self-interested people on the floor?
Well, that's there's no special point in time. What happened is, particularly with the advent of ISE, we were facing competition like we had never had before. And ISE was run much more like a company, a normal company, and not like an exchange, because they never had seat owners who were individuals. They had people, firms such as Morgan Stanley, Bear Stearns, Interactive Brokers, Citadel. They had real businesses. So when they would sit in a boardroom, they could make decisions as businesses, and we couldn't. And I went to our board and I said, we can't go on like this. We're going to have to run this place, even though we're not demutualized, as if we were. And we have a great board, and people understood it at a macro level. And so we are now in our fourth year of running ourselves as a for-profit company, even though we literally are still technically a membership organization.
Yeah, which is a really interesting concept. I mean, how do you do that? Do you set up sort of profit centers?
What we did is instead of reducing our fees to minimize it, we wanted to show the world that we could be profitable in the same way that a demutualized exchange could be. And so we now have a very strong track record, which helps us in where we're going to go from here.
Okay. Another landmark, opening the stock exchange. One would think, well, maybe you're going out of your core competency here, you know, and that your thing is options, and all of a sudden you've got a stock exchange. Tell me a little bit of the thinking behind that.
Well, you know, before we did that, we actually started a futures exchange.
Right.
So the futures exchange, I think, was significant in its own way also because we had this very special product, which was called VIX, and we wanted to trade it. And we had two choices. We could have teamed up with another exchange like the CME, which I could have done in a minute, or we could do it ourselves. And we decided that we had enough competence because we built the electronic system for our option market. When we built it so it could handle what we called multiple platforms. So one was to trade futures, one was to trade stocks, one was to trade options. So once we had the system in place, adding an exchange was easy.
Okay.
And our futures exchange actually drives a tremendous amount of business to our options market because the VIX future basically relates to volume in the S&P 500 option. So even though the futures volume on our futures exchange isn't so great, it adds lots of volume to our option market. And then the stock exchange was really another aspect. Again, having the electronic platform that runs the other markets, we could add a stock exchange very easily. And, of course, it's all under the SEC, so that was we didn't have any problem getting approval there. And the whole idea is to find ways for both our traders and our customers to do combination orders in options and stocks. Why send it to the New York Stock Exchange? Why send it to the Chicago Stock Exchange? Try to keep it within the same tent.
Last point. My whole focus here is about SROs and the nature of self-regulation.
Right.
And you've talked a lot about the membership and you know the pre-demutualized organization. How is the self-regulation of the CBOE going to change over the next period?
I don't see any major change occasioned by our demutualization. I haven't seen that at other exchanges either. Many exchanges have shed their self-regulatory function, given it to FINRA in particular. One of the things that CBOE has been very highly praised for is that because it was the first options exchange, it was always the leader in understanding option markets and self-regulation. And in fact, we right now do all the insider trading investigations on behalf of all the other options exchanges through a affiliate organization we call ORSA, which is the Options Regulatory Authority. I'm missing one letter there, but that's what ORSA is. So I don't see any substantive change. There's clearly a trend toward more consolidation of regulation, and we do cooperate with FINRA, and in fact, all our sales practice investigations, which we used to do ourselves, we have now shifted to FINRA. So I think that I don't see any real changes coming up. We take it very seriously. We've always gotten very high marks from the SEC in that regard.
Terrific. Is there anything that we haven't covered that you'd like to bring out?
We've covered a lot. I think one of the nice things of talking to you on January 5th, 2010, is that in the last 3 or 4 days, we've had articles in the newspaper about options that 5 years ago I wouldn't have believed would have been front page news in the Wall Street Journal. One of them was yesterday, literally, that was entitled... And I'll give you a copy. Options trading grew up in 2009. It's the second year in a row that more options have traded in the United States than futures. You know, people look at futures as an industry, where options is a sub-industry of the securities industry. And yet, for the second year in a row, we have traded more the options than futures. And one of the reasons is that options have a very broad audience. And we at CBOE, and I think this must be said, have made an enormous contribution to the growth of the option business, not only in product innovation and not only in regulatory activities in Washington, but in investor education. And people say to me from all over the world, because I'm now serving for the first time as chairman of the World Federation of Exchanges, the first time anyone from a derivative market's ever held that position, why do options work so well in the United States and not so well in London, not so well in Frankfurt, not so well in Japan, not so well in Singapore? And the reason is that CBOE from the very beginning educated stock investors on how to use options to enhance their stock portfolio, whether it's to protect them from the downside or increase income, and not to teach people how to speculate, which we do if we are asked, but how to take people who want to own stocks for the long term and enhance that experience. And I think these are dividends that have been paid off, and of course all the other exchanges have benefited from it. CBOE's had the Options Institute for decades now, where we've always wondered, why should we put all this money into it? We don't get a full return, but we still think it's worth it.
Yeah. Terrific.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Pleasure.